this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Prison Ache. As North Carolina's prison population ages, taxpayer-funded health care costs escalate. And that's the headline on the front page. The article actually begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Unhealthy dose. Medical care for North Carolina's aging prisoners costs the state millions, and the trend is likely to continue. This article is written by Jason DeBruin. Click a clang. Walking down the halls of Central Prison Hospital in Raleigh, a visitor might not immediately notice the differences from a community hospital. Click-a-clang. Except that thick metal doors keep patients locked securely in their rooms, every door making the loud noise of metal striking metal. Due to stricter sentencing laws adopted in the 1980s and 1990s, North Carolina's prison population swelled. As those inmates aged, the same health conditions affecting the elderly outside prison took their toll on those behind bars. Now Tar Heel taxpayers shoulder the ever-increasing health care costs of these inmates. Even with recent sentencing reforms and rising national discussion of U.S. incarceration rates, many prisoners will spend the rest of their lives behind bars. In North Carolina, that means the state will care for their chronic diseases for many years to come, and there is no quick fix. Total inmate health services costs increased from $77 million in 1997 to a budgeted $235 million this year, a more than threefold jump. Inmate medical costs make up 17% of this year's $1.36 billion adult correction budget, part of the $1.85 billion appropriated for the Department of Public Safety. From 1997 to 2014, North Carolina's overall prison population increased 27%, but in that same time, the prison population of those ages 50 and older and ages 60 and older both increased by a staggering 500%. In North Carolina, 1,818 inmates are 60 years or older, about 5% of the total population. More than 300 inmates are older than 70. Statewide, North Carolina has about 37,000 inmates in state prisons. Most of the inmates who are of the older population were sentenced before we had structured sentencing, says Representative Leo Daughtry, a Republican from Johnston County. But what should we do? Should we let them out of prison? Should we not care for them? Because those are the only two choices we have. It would be difficult to say that all people over 50 should be let out of prison. The legal framework. The aging prison population can track its roots directly to policies like the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, which stipulated mandatory minimum sentencing. These policies not only sent more people to prison, in many cases for low-level drug offenses, but also handed down much longer sentences. Most states were increasing sentencing, particularly for drug offenders, says Duke University law professor Lisa Kern Griffin. That dramatically increased the prison population. While the United States has about 5% of the world's population, it controls 25% of the worldwide prison population. That means one out of every four people in prison in the world looks out from behind bars in this country. Judge Fred Morrison, who was legal counsel to former North Carolina Governor Robert W. Scott and executive director of the North Carolina Inmate Grievance Commission from 1974 to 1981, says he used to focus his efforts on reforming inmates and seeking alternatives to incarceration. Then the mood changed to lock them up and throw away the key, which led to overcrowded, very costly prisons, Morrison says. Over time, and particularly in just the past few years, states and the federal government have been reversing course on strict sentencing guidelines, and in some cases are even releasing prisoners. Earlier this month, the U.S. Department of Justice announced it would give 6,000 inmates early release, the largest such release in U.S. history, in an effort to reduce federal prison overcrowding and alleviate the effects of harsh sentencing for drug offenders. Griffin points out that many elderly state inmates were sentenced for low-level drug offenses, not violent crimes. Not only would these inmates be at a low risk of committing violent crimes in 2015, Griffin points out that many weren't violent to begin with. All of this was in response to fear about drugs, she says. These are people who got caught up in drug trade, but almost always at very low levels. Aggravating circumstances. One of the biggest drivers of overall costs is simply the unstoppable force of time. Across the nation, more inmates are now reporting medical problems related to age. According to the survey of inmates in state and federal correctional facilities conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the two most commonly reported medical problems were arthritis and hypertension. More than 8 in 10 inmates in state and federal prisons reported receiving a medical exam or a blood test since admission. The elderly inmates suffer from the same conditions, hypertension, diabetes, chronic lung and cardiovascular diseases that affect those in the general senior population. Many will not get out of prison and have the same problems as our parents, says Cindy McLean, the Central Prison Nursing Director. In addition, inmates don't exactly fit the stereotype of who made their annual doctor checkups. Add to the equation a rough life within the prison walls, and an average inmate's body has aged about 10 years faster than the chronological age would suggest, says North Carolina Department of Public Safety Medical Director Dr. Paula Smith. A lot have abused their bodies with drugs or alcohol, which contributes to their health, says McLean. Mirroring overall health care costs, the cost per inmate also increased in 2014. The state paid an average of $6,419 in health care costs per inmate, an increase of 162% since 1997. It's still prison. Inside Central Prison, where Warden Carlton Joyner makes daily rounds, individual hospital rooms feel more like prison cells than health care accommodations. Bland cinder blocks bear down on the patients, and their walls aren't peppered with get-well cards or flowers. Some patients spend more time in a hospital cell than in a normal prison cell. James Hauser, offender number 1080649, has been in the prison hospital since it opened. At age 76, he is paralyzed in his right leg and already had his left leg amputated. Or as he likes to say, "This one don't work, and this leg I ain't got no use for because it's gone." Most days he simply sits in the hospital bed and watches the news or Family Feud, taking time to read Our Daily Bread, a Christian devotional. Convicted on April 30, 2008, of attempted first-degree sexual offense, Hauser is serving a 16-year sentence. Prisoners interviewed for this story had no complaints about the care they receive. "I can't say I've been mistreated," says Robert Rogerson, offender number 0583428, who also resides in the hospital. Convicted on July 29, 1997 of first-degree sexual offense, Rogerson, 87, is serving a life sentence. Looking for efficiencies. While prison health costs have increased sharply, the state has in recent years been able to level off and even drive down expenses in some years. That's due in large part to the $150 million five-story, 167,000-square-foot Central Prison Hospital, which brought services like diagnostics, radiology, dental, surgical, and administrative operations in-house before prisoners were sent to area hospitals for treatment. The strategy worked, reducing inmate hospital admissions by about 15% in the short term and total spending by 5% since 2010. The biggest savings came from hospital-related line items, which decreased 49% from $112 million in 2010 to $57 million in 2014. For example, an MRI scan done at a community hospital cost the prisons $5,000. Done in-house, the cost is $280. The hospital at Central Prison employs 10 physicians, 8 mid-level providers, and about 125 nursing positions. This does not include positions for outside rounds, seeing inmates who are housed at Central Prison but outside the hospital, or the mental health facility. While the Central Prison Hospital and other measures have helped to bend the cost curve, North Carolina taxpayers can expect inmate medical bills to increase again as these patients continue to age inside their cells. And even if sentencing reforms work to level off the prison population or even cause a decline, releasing inmates back to the care of their families or leaving them on their own has consequences as well. Some of those released will have nowhere to go for medical care, leaving them to turn right back to the state through Medicare, Medicaid, or both. They're not going to have any way to pay for their care, says Daughtry. It is a very sad story. And along with the cover story, there's also a related story headlined, All in a Day's Work in a Prison Hospital. The United States Constitution protects inmates from cruel and unusual punishment, and statutes require the state to provide health care to inmates. Providers who work at the prison hospital see their work is no different than any provider at Duke, UNC, or Wake Med. We are practicing consistent with what is going on in the community, says North Carolina Department of Public Safety Medical Director Dr. Paula Smith. Also, she adds that the care is out of necessity, not nicety. Inmates aren't receiving plastic surgery, for example. Ann Christopher, a physician assistant, says she views a patient in the prison hospital just like any other. We don't get involved in that part of it, she says, referring to an inmate's conviction. We know that's why they are here, but our sole responsibility is to take care of them. Treating more patients inside the prison walls also protects community hospitals from safety-related disruptions to daily operations. It solves the problem of the local hospital being not particularly happy with having to treat prisoners, says Representative Leo Daughtry, Republican, Johnston County. Treating prisoners in our own hospital is safer, and in the long run will save us money and provide better care for the prisoners. Heightened security. The prison hospital has safeguards and hospital staff trained to watch for inmate patients who might try to steal equipment through sleight of hand or force. We have a lot of the same equipment, we just handle it and account for it differently, says Cindy McLean, the Central Prison Nursing Director, with more of a mindset on security. Hospital staff say they feel safer inside the prison hospital than in other cases. Ahmed Abu Hassan is the prison hospital's urgent care center supervisor, which for all intents and purposes operates like an emergency room, but since it is not open to the public, cannot call itself an actual ER. But used to work as an ER manager in New York. In his days working on the New York streets, he says he never knew what might lurk around a corner. In the prison hospital, he knows exactly what he's walking into. This is the most secure place we can work, he says. HR challenges. Salaries for nurses in the prison system run a wide range depending on experience, but are generally similar to those offered in traditional hospital settings. A licensed practical nurse can earn between $26,000 and $52,000, and a professional nurse can earn between $39,000 and $82,000 annually. Physicians earn between $136,000 to $237,000. And psychiatrists earn up to $250,000 per year. Still, working in the prison can unnerve personnel or their families. We've lost good nurses because their spouses didn't like them working here, says McLean. Dean Doring, CEO of the Central Prison Hospital Complex, adds that working through the state's sometimes lengthy hiring process and salary approval can also frustrate potential work candidates. He has called job seekers to tell them their salary request was approved, only to hear that they took a job in the private sector weeks prior. Smith says outsiders shouldn't infer that quality suffers in any way. A lot of people in the public think that the only people who work in prisons are those who can't get other jobs, she says. That is not true. Dr. Gabriel Karamaitin, a physician, intended to stay in the system only 1 year. Now, in his 17th year, he doesn't see himself leaving. I decided I was more useful here, he says. I enjoy it. It's fulfilling at the end of the day. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. The first headline, Tar Heels Head to China. Ni Hao, That's what about 30 North Carolina delegates led by North Carolina Commerce Secretary John Skvarla will hear when they embark on a 15-day visit to China on October 24 for what Commerce and the Carolina's Chinese Chamber of Commerce officials are calling a trade mission. Based on the schedule BIS received, it looks like the group will visit the Guangxi Province, Hunan Province, Jiangsu Province, as well as Beijing, Shenzhen, and Shanghai. That's a lot of China. Among some of the noted Triangle folks joining Skvarla are Senator Tommy Tucker, Republican from Union, Chairman of the Health and Human Services Appropriations Committee, Senator Jim Davis, Republican from Macon, who heads the state's IT committee, Senator Rick Gunn, Republican, Alamance, who chairs the Commerce, Pensions, Retirement, and Aging Committees, and Wyrick Robbins' partner, Larry Robbins. The purpose of the visit is to familiarize the North Carolina government and business leaders with the opportunities in China, says Richard Yang, who heads the Carolina's Chinese Chamber of Commerce. Also make Chinese officials aware of the possibilities of joint ventures with North Carolina entities. There are several areas where we can work both ways. The cost for the trip? About $6,000 per person. McGregor Downs Country Club gets a much-needed facelift. All the changes that private equity player Newport Beach, California-based Concert Golf Partners wanted to implement at Cary's McGregor Downs Country Club seem to be paying off, at least for now. Despite a gradual drop in country club membership all over the country in the past 3 years, McGregor General Manager Russ Curtis tells Biz that the club has added 80 new members to its roster since the concert purchase last year. That may also have allowed the club to raise its entry fee from $8,250 to $10,000. Curtis adds that Concert already has poured close to $3 million of its initial $5.5 million commitment that included golf course projects, new pump station, fertigation system, new irrigation control boxes, tennis court partial lift, and new furniture. Also, a new covered deck for member dining is about to be completed. These are welcome improvements to this club, which started in 1967 and in the past decade showed its age very well. Hops for Hope raises $20,000 to transport kids. The inaugural Hops for Hope cask-off, held at Tiernanog in Raleigh on October 17, raised more than $20,000 to help raise money for the Children's Flight for Hope, an organization that provides free air transportation to and from hospitals for injured children. The concept was simple. 10 local businesses teamed up with 10 local breweries to craft unique beers done cask style. Breweries included Big Boss Brewing Company, Lone Rider Brewing Company, Aviator Brewing Company, and Crank Arm Brewery. Local businesses participating included Red Hat, NetApp, French West Vaughn, and Cap Trust. Around 400 attendees had the opportunity to root for their favorite beer alongside the judges, who were WNCN's Sean Maroney, Trophy Brewing Company's Chris Powers, and Cap Trust CEO Fielding Miller. In the end, Big Boss and the local Beer Loves team won both the People's Choice and the Judge's Choice with its Breakfast Battle Dragon, an imperial stout with maple and coffee and soaked in bourbon chips. Local blogger offers enhanced Canes coverage. With $1,878 from a Kickstarter campaign in hand, Matt Karash of Raleigh is taking on the 2015-2016 Carolina Hurricane season. Karash launched a new website, Canes and Coffee, dedicated to covering the Canes and plans on giving fans an in-depth look, or as he says it, I want to give something back to the Hurricanes hockey community and fan base, especially at a time when the franchise could use a little bit of extra help in the form of passionate support. It's no secret that Raleigh's sports media market isn't that of a New York or Philadelphia, but Karash hopes to take it one step closer. Hard-hitting Canes coverage can fall through the cracks, though Koresh doesn't blame that on the local reporters, as he says he recognizes their responsibilities are spread across other sports as well. In short, he says, Canes and Coffee will focus solely on Carolina Hurricanes hockey and will cover the team in more depth than any other print or digital media source. And in a section called You Said It, reader Facebook comments on recent TBJ stories on Raleigh to consider special parking permits for musicians. Mary Millard says, they need to fix the parking fiasco altogether. No musicians needed if no downtown patrons. Fee increases are not the answer. And Cheryl Klein says, another money grab by the city. And comments on the article, how noisy is your neighborhood? New heat map shows Raleigh-Durham decibel levels. Allie Jacobs writes, this is the type of data that should have been collected before voting on any ordinances to reduce noise downtown. According to this map, it's quieter on Fayetteville-Glenwood at night. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, sale of Raleigh's Triangle Town Center Mall now in question. The pending sale of Triangle Town Center Mall in North Raleigh appears to now be in doubt after the $171 million loan on the property that's coming due in 2 months was transferred to a special servicer pending imminent default. Mall co-owner CBL and Associates Properties had announced in early 2015 that it was working on a deal to sell an 85% majority ownership in the mall property with an unnamed institutional investment firm for a negotiated $174 million. CBL President and CEO Stephen Leibovitz had told analysts that the deal would be finalized by the end of September, but to date, no sale has been recorded in Wake County nor disclosed publicly by CBL. TREP research analyst Sean Barry explains that when a loan borrower is unable to guarantee financing before its maturity date, then the loan can be sent to special servicing. Although sources close to the deal say that negotiations are still pending with a potential lender, the special servicer assigned to the $171 million loan on the mall property, in commentary released in October, noted that CBL has so far been unable to secure financing or a sale of the property to the new investor. The property was originally appraised for $285 million in 2005, and CMBS research firm Nomura Securities International estimates a current value of $181 million. Occupancy at Triangle Town Center was 97% as of June 1. Sam's Club, Lowe's Foods buy land for expansion in the Triangle. Wholesale retail club operator Sam's Club and regional grocery chain Lowe's Foods have struck out on their own buying land in Wake Forest and in Cary, respectively, for new location expansion plans in the Triangle. Sam's Club, a division of Walmart, paid $2.5 million for 13 acres in the shops at Cavernous Farms Retail Center at the intersection of US 1 and Caveness Farms Avenue in Wake Forest that Weingarten Realty has been planning for several years. Sam's Club plans to build a 140,000 square foot store that should open in 2016. Weingarten plans to also add another 100,000 square foot of retail space at the center for three junior retail anchor shops, but the Real Estate Investment Trust has not yet disclosed which shops will be moving in. Lowe's Foods in Cary paid nearly $3.5 million for a 13.5-acre parcel of land behind the Greystone residential community that M&I Homes began building in 2005. Lowe's Foods executives say construction of the new store will be timed to coincide with the planned $17.5 million extension of Morrisville Parkway to NC 540. The store will be located at the future intersection of Mills Park Drive and Morrisville Parkway. The Winston-Salem-based grocer also recently completed a remodel on many of its Triangle stores, including locations in Cary, Raleigh, and Knightdale. Luxury home architect to lead 12-day building blitz for new Chapel Hill Church. Chapel Hill architect Keith Shaw may be better known in the market for his detailed home designs for projects around Governor's Club and other high-end Chapel Hill neighborhoods. But starting October 25, Shaw will be leading a team of about 75 volunteers building a new church over the course of 12 days. Shaw, a lay leader at New Life Fellowship Church in Durham and principal of Shaw Design Associates, will be directing the building project on the church's new campus at 166 Weaver Dairy Road in Chapel Hill. Shaw says it's taken the church 10 years since the land was purchased to get to this point due to delays in nearby road construction and time to secure all the city permits. But we don't have a choice but to get started now, he says. About 50 volunteers affiliated with Maranatha International, a nonprofit ministry of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, will descend on Chapel Hill over the next 2 weeks. But by the end of the 2 weeks, the exterior of the 6,184-square-foot fellowship hall and classroom building and most of the interior walls should be finished. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Healthcare page written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, after raising $150 million, Humacyte plans next moves. With a cash infusion of up to $150 million, biotech Humacyte can set its sights on a Phase 3 trial, a U.S. Food and Drug Administration submission, and even a product launch if all goes well. Humacyte announced October 20th that it raised $150 million from private investors, one of the largest single investments ever in the biotechnology company, but the investment in no way guarantees success. This round of funding is a significant endorsement of years of research and work to develop a novel acellular vessel and lays a path forward in discovering new technology and science in the field of tissue engineering, says Dr. Laura Nicholson, Humacyte's co-founder. Humacyte employs 51, of which more than half have advanced degrees. Humacyte is developing a product that would serve as a conduit to connect a vein and an artery in the arm to then filter blood out of the body. This is important particularly for patients with kidney failure who require hemodialysis. The kidney cleanses blood, but when the kidney stops working, patients must go through a process of circulating blood out of the body, typically through the forearm, through a cleansing machine, and back into the body. Some patients require this process as much as 3 times per week. To make the process run more smoothly, these patients have a tube-like product implanted into their arms that allows for easier access to a blood vein. The Humacyte device, a human acellular vessel called Humacyl, is that product. Humacyl holds great potential to be transformative for patients who suffer from end-stage renal disease when kidneys fail completely, and we are very proud to have the investor support to complete further research and development to expand our pipeline and to grow, says Nicholson. The patient has always been at the heart of our work, and that commitment will always remain at the forefront of Humacyte. The market for Humacyl is small. Only about 419,000 patients require hemodialysis, and Humacyte leadership readily call their target a targeted market. The $150 million raised would give Humacyte a little more than $200 million raised since 2006. If the Phase 3 trial goes well, give the company enough money to file an application with the FDA and launch the product in the U.S. without a partner. This is a luxury not many biotechnology companies can afford. Launching a product targeted at a larger market requires a larger sales force, and companies often partner with Big Pharma to help market their new product. With such a partnership, however, the biotechnology company must also sign away a portion of the product's revenue to the larger company, something that Humacyte could avoid. Also, Humacyte received fast-track designation for Humacyl for vascular access in hemodialysis patients from the FDA in 2014, which allows for a smoother application process. It has ongoing phase 2 trials in the U.S. and European Union for patients with end-stage renal disease who require vascular access for hemodialysis. Of course, the larger cardiovascular disease market is many multiples larger, and Humacyte could potentially target those markets in the future. And in a section called C-Suite Shuffle, almost 2 years after John Ratliff resigned from his position as Quintiles' chief operating officer, the company announced Chief Finance Officer Kevin Gordon would officially take over the role. In addition, Quintiles hired Michael McDonnell, most recently CFO of Intelsat, to replace Gordon as CFO. In many ways, Quintiles, which contracts with pharmaceutical companies to run tests on experimental new drugs, is simply formalizing many of the functions Gordon already had been performing, said Quintiles CEO Tom Pike. And finally, in a section called Pharma Corner, adverse events reported in drug trial. Shares of Chapel Hill drug developer Sempra dropped after the company revealed its experimental pneumonia treatment caused adverse events in study patients. Shares traded as low as $15.88 on October 16, but rallied to close at $19.29, down 28% from the previous day. Sempra is developing a drug called solithromycin to treat community-acquired bacterial pneumonia, the number one cause of death from an infection, particularly in the very young and in older patients. In late-stage testing, the drug showed some good results and met endpoints that Sempra set out to achieve. However, there were also adverse events reported in the study, which led investors to sell off the stock. And now we turn to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, What the Red Hat Ansible Deal Means for the Triangle. Open source giant Red Hat just got bigger. The company, based at Red Hat Tower in downtown Raleigh, has closed on its buyout of Ansible, a Durham startup developing open source IT automation software. Ansible CEO Saeed Zuwani isn't talking price tags. He won't confirm or deny reports that suggest Red Hat is paying upwards of $150 million, but he does say, we're happy with the outcome. Zuwani and fellow ex-Red Hatter started the company 3 years ago, never expecting the huge growth trajectory that would follow. Today, 50 employees work out of its new headquarters overlooking the ballpark in downtown Durham, and it's likely that number will increase and soon. We're going to have to accelerate our hiring plan, he says. Previously, the team leveraged about a dozen of its own inside sales associates. Now we can leverage hundreds and hundreds globally. For that reason alone, we'll need more support and more services. We'll also need the bandwidth to do more with the product. Red Hat 2 says growth, not layoffs, are in the cards for Ansible's employees. Joe Fitzgerald, Vice President of Cloud Management at Red Hat, says Ansible's Durham space, not just its technology, presents an opportunity, as Red Hat has nearly filled its own headquarters to capacity. It gives us options and choices, he says. About 1,200 employees currently work in the tower, and with plans to hire 3,000 across the company in 2015, that number ticks upward every day. This is a fast-growing technology, he says. We're not buying them for their revenues. We're buying them for their future. We're going to ramp up. We're going to invest in it, and we're going to integrate it. And that could mean taking even more space in the building, Fitzgerald predicts. Ansible, which will be keeping its name, aims to reduce the complexity of IT operations through its technology. Part of the drag on IT is the complexity, Fitzgerald explains, adding that tools in different spaces come with their own languages and their own semantics. You have to find people to train them. Ansible, he says, takes the friction out, with playbooks he calls human-readable and agent-free. That sounds like a technical term, but if the first thing you have to do to manage your environment is to go put an agent on everything you want to manage, that introduces overhead up front, he says. Former Medtronic CEO shares leadership tips. Bill George, the CEO that took Medtronic from a $1.1 billion market capitalization to $65 billion, brought a leader-heavy crowd to downtown Raleigh October 19 for the launch of his new book, Discover Your True North, where he told them directly that leadership can't just be about the balance sheet. In attendance were a few people used to talking numbers, such as Channel Advisor CEO David Spitz, CEPI Engineering and Construction CEO CEPI Saidi, Highwood CEO Ed Frisch, former IBM site lead Dick Doherty, Empire Property CEO Greg Haddam, and MCNC CEO Gene Davis. George says he was on track to lead global technology firm Honeywell when he realized he was miserable. An epiphany led him to the best 12 years of my life, he says, when he left the company for the much smaller Medtronic. Satisfaction is achieved by focusing on what you want, not what you think you want, he says, bringing two Raleigh businessmen in front of the crowd to prove his point. Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat, and Jesse Lipson, site lead for Citrix's Raleigh operation. Whitehurst, too, left a cushy job for something completely different. In his case, it was Delta for Red Hat. I think a lot of people get enamored with size versus what gets you up and gets you excited every day, he says. Lipson, vice president and general manager, workflow and workspace clouds at Citrix, did the opposite. He moved from something small to something bigger when the company he founded a decade ago, ShareFile, was bought out by Citrix. ShareFile had 80 employees when it was acquired, a move that propelled the headcount to expand more than 600 in downtown Raleigh. And finally, in a section called They Said It, overheard at the All Things Open conference in downtown Raleigh on October 19, a quote from Mark Scarpness, director of embedded software at the Open Source Technology Center at Intel. We have, in the open source community, created a great set of technology building blocks and tools, but we need help to build to help bridge the gap, connect those two together. Sarah Novotny, community manager at Nginx. I liken the cloud today very much to Edison's time and electricity. There was a point in time where you had to have an electric generator if you wanted to run power. There was not a standardized socket for many, many years. And from Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat, nobody says, give me a great bureaucracy so I can come up with something new. And we have two articles on the On Transportation page written by Jeff Jeffrey. The first, Street Art Splashes on Glenwood. Art often appears in the strangest places. Residents of Raleigh's Glenwood South neighborhood can now find it right beneath their feet. The city teamed up with several local artists to paint three permanent street art installations in area crosswalks. The artists painted different designs in the intersections of Glenwood Avenue and Jones, North, and Tucker Streets. This underscores that Raleigh has a very talented and creative community, says Donna Belt, a local artist who lives in Glenwood South and came up with the idea. It shows that our Glenwood South neighborhood welcomes new forms of art and innovative works like this one. The first installation, which is located at the Tucker Street intersection, shows a city skyline, according to a design by Lindsay Barker and Anna Gerzik. The second, at North Street, depicts a swimmer in a striped bathing suit. The swimmer installation was designed by Martha Thorne. Finally, the installation on Jones Street resembles an old-fashioned movie reel countdown and was designed by Amanda Snavely. To make the project work, local citizen groups worked with several departments of Raleigh government. City leaders had to sign off on the project. The Raleigh Public Works Department helped select the intersections where the installations would go. Design for the art installations were selected by the Raleigh Arts Commission out of several submissions. Other groups that were involved included the Cook's Walkings Project and the Glenwood South Neighborhood Collaborative. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance helped organize the effort and worked with Raleigh officials to ensure everything was done according to regulation. Alliance President and CEO David Diaz says the project is a good example of citizens working with government to help improve the city in which they live. "This is exactly the kind of collaboration we want to encourage," Diaz says. "It's really cool to see a project where the talents of our citizens are being used to the benefit of everyone." New Wake County Bridge opens ahead of schedule. The North Carolina Department of Transportation opened a new bridge in southeast Wake County that is expected to shorten the commute of more than 3,000 drivers a day. The new bridge carries Auburn-Knightdale Road over the Neuse River. NCDOT was able to open the bridge 6 weeks ahead of schedule. The bridge was scheduled to open just in time for Thanksgiving, but crews were able to get it done early. It replaces a 50-year-old, 370-foot bridge that was outdated and in need of constant repairs. The 14-month replacement project required drivers in the area to take a 9-mile detour from Battle Bridge Road, west of the Neuse River, to Grasshopper Road, east of the river. The Auburn-Knightdale Road Bridge is the fifth of 7 new Wake County bridges being built under an $8.1 million contract awarded to S.T. Wooten of Wilson in May 2012. Still to come under that contract are bridges on Wagstaff Road in Fuquay Varina and on Trailwood Drive in Raleigh. The Wagstaff Road Bridge is scheduled to open in March. The Trailwood Drive Bridge project is part of a partnership with Raleigh and is expected to cost about $1.7 million, with the city contributing $289,000. Raleigh is also partnering with NCDOT on a $75 million effort to replace bridges carrying Capitol Boulevard over Peace Street and Wade Avenue near downtown. Elsewhere in Wake County, North Carolina Railroad Company is partnering with the town of Morrisville to build a new $8 million bridge over Crabtree Creek. NCRR is putting $6.9 million toward the bridge project, and Morrisville is contributing $1 million. That project is expected to be complete in 2018. And now we turn to the A Better World page, written by Todd Cohen. And we start with his column. Todd Cohen also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline on his column: Help for Low-Income Pet Owners. Each year throughout North Carolina, with animal shelters struggling to handle an escalating population of cats and dogs, 160,000 animals are euthanized, including about 16,000 in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties. In the Triangle, the annual cost to taxpayers to run animal shelters is $5 million. And low-income communities generate an estimated 85% to 90% of the pet population. Less fortunate communities don't have the information or financial resources and live in pet care deserts, says Martin Banning, executive director of Animal Kind. Animal Kind, a Raleigh nonprofit, aims to end the unnecessary euthanasia of adoptable cats and dogs in North Carolina shelters by targeting its work in low-income communities. In 2014, through a voucher program that charges a $20 copay for spaying or neutering that typically costs $100 to $150, Animal Kind contracted with local veterinarians and clinics that performed 938 surgeries in Cary and in Caswell, Durham, Orange, and Person counties. In September, it expanded the program to Alamance County. If it can secure funding, it wants to expand to Chatham, Harnett, and Johnston counties. Helping to reimburse the cost of the surgeries is the spay-neuter program of the Animal Welfare Section of the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, using revenue from the sales by the State Division of Motor Vehicles of the iCare license plate. Last year, the state sold nearly 8,000 of those plates, generating more than $159,000, says Penny Page, spay-neuter coordinator for the Animal Welfare Section. The plates cost $30 more than standard plates, with $20 from each plate going to the spay-neuter program. Founded in 1998 and operating with an annual budget of $500,000 and a staff of four people working full-time and eight working part-time, Animalkind in September launched a pilot program in Alamance County to provide free spay and neutering surgeries. It targets high-poverty, low-income zip code areas. Through the program, Animalkind connects pet owners with free pet food, vaccines, and animal welfare services. Animalkind raised $55,000 to launch the pilot and aims to raise $75,000 each to expand it to Wake and Orange counties. Animalkind also operates the Spay NC Helpline at 1-888-NC-FIX-EM, which connects callers with reduced-cost clinics, vets, and pet care resources. The helpline fields about 100 calls per month and is tied to an online map used by 1,300 to 1,500 visitors per month. In Caswell and Person counties, through a partnership with Planned Pethood, a Greensboro clinic, Animalkind also pays to transport pets to be spayed or neutered. Animalkind generates about 60% of its budget through a retail thrift shop it operates at 2120 Spring Forest Road. It is also hiring its first development director, who will work to diversify its funding base. Until we get into the neighborhoods and spay and neuter the pets that can be spayed and neutered, Banning says, we're going to have the rescues and shelters overwhelmed. And in nonprofit news, Bayer Crop Science works the farm. Nearly 100 Bayer Crop Science employees, including Jim Blome, president and CEO of RTP-based Bayer Crop Science North America, joined forces with the Society of St. Andrew to pick sweet potatoes from a Fuquay Varina farm on October 19. The 8,051 pounds of sweet potatoes were donated to the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. Carrie John Deere helps build Habitat House. The Carrie offices of the John Deere Agriculture and Turf Division will help Habitat for Humanity of Wake County build a home. The project broke ground October 19 at the corner of Evans and Rochelle Roads in Carrie. As a Platinum Hammer sponsor for this build, the John Deere Foundation provided financial support, and local John Deere employees will work alongside the family and other volunteers to complete the home build, one of 50 homes being constructed by Habitat Wake in 2015. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page. First we'll read the column written by Patrick McHugh, who specializes in budget and tax issues for the North Carolina Justice Center in Raleigh. The headline on the column, How We Avoided the Next Great Recession. The Great Recession would have become the Great Depression 2.0 without the effective response of federal policy, according to a new report. Using Moody's Analytics' highly respected macroeconomic model, the report authors estimate that if the federal government had not used fiscal, monetary, and spending policy tools, the national economy would have lost twice as many jobs, and the economic downturn would have lasted twice as long. After 7 years of an official recovery and a state policy debate that often ignores our country's most recent and historic downturn, it can be easy to forget just how bleak things looked in 2008 and 2009. North Carolina lost nearly 8% of its jobs from the start of the Great Recession to the trough in the labor market, and unemployment remained in the double digits for 34 months from February 2009 until October 2011. Yet things could have been worse, much worse. Absent federal interventions, the national unemployment rate could have ballooned to almost 16% and would have been in the double digits up through last year. Aggressive moves to prop up the financial markets and boost the economy through direct government spending moved the economy back into growth mode earlier and eased the economic harm of job losses. The report also provides evidence that most types of direct government spending had more effect than tax cuts. The federal response included both tax cuts and increases in government spending. direct spending generally produced higher benefits, and the best economic bang for the buck came from programs that provided assistance to people struggling to survive the recession, such as increasing the value of food assistance and access by waiving time limits for childless adults and extending the length of time that jobless workers could continue to receive unemployment benefits. A key lesson of the Great Recession and current recovery is that it can be damaging to have quick swings from stimulus to austerity before the economy has achieved self-sustaining growth. Efforts in the late 2008 and early 2009 kept the recession from becoming a depression, but subsequent choices like sequestration have contributed to the slow pace of the recovery. A central lesson for North Carolina is that cutting back on programs that help people weather bad economic times actually makes those times even worse. North Carolina leaders have chosen to cut back on many of the types of programs that got the country through the recession. When our state dramatically reduced the length of time that people who lost their jobs could depend on unemployment insurance, it hurt the entire economy. When we limit access to food assistance, even in places where there still are not enough jobs, local economies suffer. Minimizing the harm of economic downturns to people and communities makes for quicker and stronger recoveries. And also we have the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, No to New Parking Fees. First came the quiet voice of some prominent downtown Raleigh stakeholders who whispered that the new office and apartment condo buildings lack visual vision and artistry. Then came the drunk town ads with some not-so-silent constituents stating downtown Raleigh is turning into a place where booze is the prime attraction. Now comes the issue of parking, whether or not to charge people for parking on weekends and weeknights. Are these the signs of a downtown growing up? You bet. We are dealing with several issues here. Some have to do with private money, architecture, design, and layout of buildings, and Raleigh city leaders have limited say on those issues. Of course, they could say a building's design does not meet the visual code, but I don't believe we have such a code in place for the new high-rise buildings that don our skyline. So we come to another two issues where city officials and the city council can directly bring change. Much has been talked about the drunk town ad during the recent mayoral and city elections. No reason to light that fire again. So we come to parking. From what I have read so far, Raleigh was headed the wrong way in terms of parking fees in downtown Raleigh. On October 20, they at least managed to stop the car. According to city officials, we need a little more than $1 million annually to repair equipment and pay out contractors for parking deck cleaning services. Raleigh's annual budget is in excess of $830 million. Surely we can find a way to absorb the $1 million to $1.2 million cost for now. If you want downtown Raleigh to spread its wings, don't make it tough on people to go there by imposing fees. Folks in North Raleigh, Cary, Fuquay, and Apex have other options. You keep on charging them $5 for parking on weeknights or on weekends, and they will go somewhere else. Downtown Raleigh is far from reaching critical mass. Just ask Downtown Raleigh Alliance for the stat on business closures every year. It's big. Agreed, new retailers are moving in, so spaces are being filled up, but we still do not have enough people to support all the available commerce. Why would you want to make it any more difficult for the business owners? The Raleigh City Council has agreed to look at an alternative plan next month. We just hope that free parking on weeknights and weekends are totally off the table for now. There will be a time to charge for parking 24/7 in downtown Raleigh. It simply is not now. And with our remaining time with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read from the People on the Move page. In the spotlight is Sharon Hirsch, CEO of Prevent Child Abuse North Carolina. After having served for nearly 5 years as the executive director of Donate Life North Carolina, Sharon Hirsch has been named CEO of Prevent Child Abuse North Carolina, the statewide chapter of Prevent Child Abuse America. Through collaboration with partners across North Carolina, PCANC works with communities to build safe, stable, nurturing relationships for all children with the goal of preventing child abuse and neglect. As CEO, Hirsch is responsible for the overall direction of the organization, including strategic planning, fundraising, financial management, public awareness, and education about its work. The Raleigh-based organization works with partners in all 100 North Carolina counties. It employs a total of 17 people, 11 of whom are based in the Triangle. What is the one thing you wish people knew about your job? My work is based in optimism and hope for the future of North Carolina's children. Our work fosters safety, stability, and nurturing relationships for children and their families. Investing in the future of our children is so gratifying. All that we do fosters the development of safe, secure, and nurturing environments to help children learn, grow, and thrive as they grow into productive, healthy, and contributing citizens of North Carolina. Major goals in your position? We are fortunate to have long-term relationships with key partners. I want to continue to enhance those relationships so we can collectively work towards our goal of helping all children thrive while also building new relationships to expand awareness of and support for our work. As with most nonprofits, one of our biggest goals is to stabilize and expand funding to support our important work. I want to encourage more leaders across the state to learn about our work and how it impacts them and their community, and help them understand how their communities can support us too. Biggest pet peeve? Being late is my biggest pet peeve. Biggest worry? Funding. Isn't that everyone's biggest worry in the nonprofit world? A Triangle business person you most admire? Kevin Trapani, president and CEO of the Redwoods Group. Personal, husband Steve, children Matt and Katie. Last book you've read, The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd. And that's going to do it for us. We've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.